This is an example of speech.
All our history.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge, thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blow hard, evergreen topical heatwave of a weekly conversation turned podcast, in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment sections in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. You can contact us at tmwttpod@gmail.com. I'm Peter Albrill. You can contact me on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis. And I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at Green_Weird, which is WYRD. This episode, we have weak thoughts about baking rights, an interview with Scott Gordon from WisContext, and closing thoughts about police violence and tech giants. Prepare to get righteous and reactionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now for some weak thoughts.
Those who benefit never ask why. Just sit back and enjoy some cocoa beans. And don't wonder what profit really means. Follow dictates from the ivory tower. Waste your life in a struggle for power. All men thus reduce to please.
All right, welcome, welcome, welcome everybody to Tell Me What to Think. You can email the podcast at tmwttpod@gmail.com. You can find us on Google Play and Apple Pods, and reviews, I guess, help us. That's what I hear. And you can often find stories we're going to talk about on Twitter with hashtag TMWTT. And this episode, you'll hear an interview with WisContext's journalist Scott Gordon. Does a lot of good kind of policy and environmental reporting in Wisconsin. And
real meaty stuff.
What was that?
Real meaty stuff.
Yeah, yeah. That's yeah. It's cool. Like it's not just like re-reporting, like rewording an AP, you know, a little short news story. All right. What is happening in the world?
The Koreans are trying to get that peace summit off the ground, almost despite Donald Trump and Mike Pence and John Bolton's efforts to sideline it.
Yeah, they tried hard.
They're really trying.
Although, I do think I maybe disagree a little bit that Trump is trying not to have it. I think he does want it. I think he wants it more than he wants the results that it could lead to. Does that make sense? Like, he just wants to say he did it.
Right.
I think more so than, because he just assumes his force of personality will get the results.
Yeah, it's trying to view it in, like, some base transactional sense when this is, like, a thorny, decades-long problem that has just been lingering.
I wonder if Donald Trump knows why we have troops there. Like, originally, why we have troops there.
I mean, he's got to be old enough to, like, he's met Korean War veterans when he was a kid, at least. Right? How old is he?
He's 72? 3? Something like that.
Okay, so that would, yeah, he would have been born, like, 48? Yeah, but Korean War was going on when he was a child.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's, yeah.
I mean, whether or not he knows, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's, like, I don't know. Who knows what he knows? He doesn't know what he knows. He thinks he knows everything. Yeah, so, like, I saw a story today that we were joking about earlier. Like, Kim Jong-un's right-hand man was meeting at the White House with Pompeo, and they didn't have Bolton in the meeting, which is striking some as meaning they're trying to not take a threatening hawkish approach, despite, as you referenced, Bolton, Pence, and I think Pompeo. Did Pompeo make like a Libya comment?
No, I think it was just the two of them.
Okay,
but
okay, yeah.
I mean, the North Koreans like specifically said that they found John Bolton to be repugnant, so I could understand not having him in the meeting.
Yep, yep.
I mean, that's just like, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, because would they even agree to be talking with him in the room?
No, absolutely not, you know, right?
Yeah. No, that's a legitimate concern.
So maybe Donald Trump has learned like that .098 diplomacy lesson. Like, hey, make sure everybody isn't going to march out of the room.
Yep. There was some. I mean, we talked about immigration on last week's episode, and Senator Merkley.
Yeah, Jeff Merkley from Oregon.
Kind of made some headlines for wanting to go into it was a facility where they have children, right?
Yeah, it's in Brownsville, Texas. I mean, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's somewhere in Texas. But yeah, he tried to visit the facility, a former Walmart, and the private company, I think, don't quote me on this, but I think it's Geo Group or one of the other private contractors. But yeah, they called the police on him to get him to leave. So there's your federal oversight. In addition, for the numerous other reasons to be mad about this, I'm sure they're not collecting data on how many children they're separating or who their parents are, whether or not they're migrants or, as we covered in the previous pod, migrants or refugees, which I would assume that this, at least a simple majority of these people are refugees.
Yeah, you'd assume so. The idea of them not having data on it, I mean, there is kind of this right-wing pattern of not wanting data on governmental issues or programs so as to not be able to use data against them, I guess.
There won't be evidence later. It's not the Holocaust that got the Nazis in trouble. It was keeping detailed lists yes. That people were able to use later.
If only we didn't know there were 12 million killed. And yes, we're comparing Republicans to Nazis.
Well, I mean, they separate children from their parents out of their petty spite. So the comparison might be a little bit more apt than it was in previous years.
There was kind of slightly anticlimactic Supreme Court ruling, but it's getting a lot of buzz
Disproportionate amount of buzz for the very slight technical narrow response that the Supreme Court issued.
Yeah, I don't think it's disproportional though compared to the build up. Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's been talked about for a couple of years. This has been a hot button, kind of taking two polar sides of our kind of national civil rights discussion and pitting them against each other. The ruling, and we made sure to have our legal editor, Dave, chime in on this for us. I have seen this reported elsewhere beyond kind of like the hot takes. But it essentially ruled that the Civil Rights Division in Colorado discriminated against the baker who refused to make a cake for a gay couple. Part of their ruling, I believe, was because part of the Supreme Court's ruling on the way they did was because gay marriage was illegal at that time in Colorado.
Right.
Which actually kind of does make sense to me.
Yeah, it's like to be they honest. Kind of overturned it. I mean, it's a politically convenient way for them to like deflect it on, you know, a purely technical sense.
Yeah, I think I was reading a little bit on this, and I'm going beyond the scope of of what Dave wrote us, but I believe I can say this confidently that Ruth Bader Ginsburg made a, you know, I think kind of made a point similar to what you're saying, is that, you know, this is the issue is bigger than than just this case. And but I believe what I was going to say is I actually believe Clarence Thomas pointed out kind of how it's politically convenient. Now, that, you know, I'm assuming that he would kind of want to lean one way on it.
Assumedly.
If it was broader. But he, I believe in his, what's it called? A concurrent opinion. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. It's like, I agree, but for a slightly different reason.
Yeah. So anyway, it's interesting. I was reading some of it. There were like, I'd have to get this from Dave if this is a lot, but there were something like 3 or 4. It wasn't just like the normal, you know, majority opinion and dissent. There were, I think it's like 2, 3, or 4 other, you know, like these two justices wrote this agreeing with the majority. And then this one also wrote, these two wrote a different one. And I got this, even though it was, I think, a 7-2 ruling, it does seem like there's a lot of dissent in the court on this one.
Yeah, it's a real big thorny issue that they could, that there's a lot of different ways to slice that apple.
Yeah, I guess I should say there's a lot of dissent amongst the thorns. Maybe, again, not this case in and of itself, if you're looking at it narrowly, but, you know, they're smart people. They know that there's implications.
Yeah, they're scholarly. They're of a scholarly bent, right? They're prodigious authors, so of course they're going to write 30 pages on why this is terrible or not.
Yeah, they can't help it. You know, it's their job.
What we hired them for.
Yep. Well, I guess, we did through the president and Senate approval. Here's the one thing, though. So now this is a narrow ruling, so, you know, everything I'm about to say, grain of salt. But it strikes me that the natural, to me, extent of this line of thinking from the religious freedom Christian side, you know, kind of stepping away from this case, but just this type of thing. I have a right to not serve a certain group of people because of some sort of religious belief. It strikes me that this could be and will be turned back on them in some way, shape, or form.
What, against Christians? Or?
Yes. Which they already think is happening. But I mean, like, not getting services at commercial, you know, stores and whatever.
Really? You think that'll be a problem?
I don't see how it wouldn't be if they got what they wanted, which is they want to not be able to serve or hire certain... Because, like, wasn't there something in the early Trump administration where they either took off or made sure not to include, like, transgender people under, like, employment protections?
Mm-hmm.
And... And the logic is, for a lot of this, is...
Well, some weird bathroom issue.
Yeah, and there's like these... I mean, there's definitely kind of a broad culture war, but to me there is... I mean, I empathize, actually, with the religious freedom. How can you not? Like, I'm an atheist, you know, like I...
They want the right to be offended and have their offense mean something. I get that.
But I mean, I don't want to live in a place where people don't have religious freedom, obviously. It's just that I think that they're taking it too far, and I think they're losing the broader culture war, and that this could... Like, does a Christian not want to be able to buy clothes at a... I mean, it wouldn't
Jewish
be for religion.
Or Hindu, like, or Muslim or any other number of religious denominations. Yeah.
I'm thinking, like, okay, there's got to be gay cake makers out there. And now being gay isn't a religion, so, I mean, I understand there's a difference, but...
Well, there's got to be, like, as I was saying, like, Hindu or Muslim or...
Yeah.
You know, what's... Yeah. If those one of those people were at the end of their rope, I mean, wouldn't they also be within their rights to be like, I don't want to put a giant Christian cross on a wedding cake or for any kind of cake?
Especially in, okay, so maybe that's not going to happen, say, in a place, you know, flyover country or whatever, that has, like, a clear majority of Protestant Christians and, you know, Catholics. But what about in a more urban setting with higher atheist rates, higher diversity of other religions, where there isn't this clear majority of, you know, practicing evangelical Christians?
Can we backtrack 1 second? I just got to put some holes in that other theory. Like, flyover country being monogamous or homogenous grossly overreported.
I know. But there are I just meant places within flyover country. I don't mean... Oh, okay. I'm not trying to broadly say it's all the same, obviously. I don't... I don't fit in that.
Oklahoma's surprisingly Muslim, for instance.
Excuse me. But, you know, the places where you are going to find 30,000 people towns where they have a church that holds 40,000, you know.
Those places have, like, 3 dozen churches, right?
Yeah, but you know what I mean, though. Like,
yeah, okay.
And, you know, they every single elected official from the state is a Republican, and they all...
Well, and that's kind of like, well, another part of why they have to use the legal courtroom or the legal system to fight these wars is that it's such kind of, even among Christians, it's not necessarily a widespread or deeply held belief. So one person can make a case out of it that sets a precedent for everybody else who doesn't necessarily agree, because, I don't know, I'm pretty sure Jesus would have baked a cake for gay people. Like, about turning another cheek, I don't know. Love your neighbor, I don't know. He said a few different things, but, you know, he's a hippie and mumbled a lot, probably.
Hung around with a sex worker, I mean.
Right? Criminals.
Anyway, so that's that news. I, frankly, whenever I see the, like, Google News alerts and all that, and news stories on, the Twitters and wherever else I'm looking for news, and I see, like, Supreme Court ruling, I'm just holding my breath until the, what is it, Whitford, the Wisconsin...
The redistricting? Yeah.
I'm just, like, bated breath. I don't know how it's gonna go. I'm super excited and dreading it, and...
It's kind of a pall over our whole, like, state body politic this year.
Agreed.
Like, I feel like campaigns are usually kicking off into higher intensity than they are now.
I've seen a little bit more campaigns picking up some steam, but I agree. I don't know that any of us, even if we had legal editor Dave on, could answer this, but, do we think that if they ruled tomorrow, which could happen, today it could happen,
it's any day now,
on this case, and let's say they said it's horribly partisan gerrymandered. Would they redistrict before November?
I assume that would be nearly impossible.
They redistricted. It was a state ruling, but they redistricted
Pennsylvania. Yeah.
They did that fast.
I suppose this is just on one hand, it's just about arranging deck chairs.
Yeah.
So, you know, rearranging bureaucratic charts. It's like, no, you now report to this district, and you guys are now in the first congressional district. But it's such a thorny political question that I suspect that they're going to say that this is terrible, you have to do it again, and put the onus on the state rather than trying to establish a very narrow and specific judicial precedent in something that is such a political problem and so prevalent across the entire country.
It just seems that if our rights are being infringed by this gerrymandering, and the Supreme Court agreed that it would be unjust to hold an election with these same boundaries.
Absolutely.
And I think that, the fact that Scott Walker didn't want to hold those two special elections, which I think are coming up, is that today?
Yeah, one of them is today. Also, California is voting today.
Oh, so that'll be fun. That's a thing.
Yeah, it's a huge thing.
Well, I got distracted by this special election idea. So I've been hearing a lot of ads against for this special election, and I did a little reporting. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but looking into reports, and there's been like hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on these special elections, which I believe are only going to last until November.
Yep.
And they might not even... Are they even going to be in session at all? I don't think so.
They'll probably be in session in the fall, right?
Oh, and before the new people get...
elected.
Okay. Well, yeah. Well, regardless. But it's not a long time, is the point. And it just really surprised me that... And it was mostly coming from conservative groups. The ads that I've been hearing have been, like, just trashing on some... I don't have the names in front of me yet, but some lady who's running on the Democratic side for one of these, just like really, really negative ads. And it's like, can they not help themselves? Can they not just say, you know what? Maybe this one we can just sit out. Is it because incumbents generally win? I don't understand the logic of going so negative, so hard.
For what, the Senate seat, the guy retired or moved on?
One of them took a position in the
Trump administration. No.
Walker administration.
Oh, Walker administration, right. And that's one of the seats, so there just isn't an incumbent, which is, you know, going to draw a lot of money for that.
But, okay, no, so, by the way, it's... Next week is the special election.
Oh, okay. Next week. I thought it was today.
Yeah, I knew it was early June. Yeah, California is today, and I knew the special elections were early. It's just so we get this on the record, Senate District 1 and Assembly District 42. We'll move on after this. I just looked this up on Google just so I could get those two down. It's I'm on the Wisconsin Elections Commission website, and I suppose what I'm about to read is technically true, but this is... The governor ordered special elections in State Senate District 1 and Assembly District 42 to fill seats held by blah, blah, blah. He was court-ordered to... I mean... Technically, he was court-ordered and then did order. And not that it's the commission's stupid website job to give full context, but it's just a little...
Kind of throwing him under the bus.
Bugging me.
He was ordered to do this.
Yeah. Well, they're making it sound like he just did it, which... I don't know. Anyway, yeah, I don't know. Those negative ads were just bugging me when I started hearing them. I think I saw them on radio and TV. Like, I saw a TV ad on local TV about this.
What?
Because one of them's, I think, in...
Dane County?
Yeah, Assembly District 42 is... It says South Central Wisconsin. It's close. If it's not in Dane County, it is very... It's within the media... group or district of Madison. Yeah, it's just above. If it's not technically Dane County, it partially is. Yeah,
it's in the TV market.
Yeah, it's kind of between here and like Fond du Lac, sort of. So, anyway, any other kind of national, international things going on you want to touch on?
Let's see. We talked about Bolton. We talked about immigration.
I saw MBS was having a new round of arrests.
Oh, yeah. He's arresting the women who were advocating for women to get driver's licenses.
Wasn't that his idea? Not idea, but you know what I mean? Like, wasn't he pushing for that?
He kind of went along with it. I mean, that's just kind of one of those changes where a country is trying to modernize and be like everybody else in the entire world, so...
I mean, does this put to rest this notion that, oh, it's worth him doing all these other things because he's modernizing Saudi Arabia?
Yes, and then, but he's also, he's putting the opinion makers behind bars because, you know, they want to tightly control opinion and how things move forward, especially for their big 2030 project that they're about to start, which involves a huge sale to the tunes of, like, billions of dollars of 5% of the Saudi state oil firm Aramco.
Oh yeah, it's IPO.
Yeah, initial public offering.
Yeah, yeah, that's part of why he was in the States, right? Was drumming up some investors or something.
Yeah, and he was meeting with all those huge companies who will notionally invest money into his company in the form of stocks.
Hmm. All right. Anyone?
But yeah, none of those people have said shit about any of his authoritarian leanings.
Of the American potential investors.
Yeah, Bill Gates and all the media and technology titans he met with while he was here.
Yeah, I mean, I could see maybe, you know, it's just not. It's not what billionaires do. Mostly.
Man, don't take that meeting and don't be in that photograph. That's all I gotta say.
Yeah.
Oh, should we talk about the foolish, I guess, FBI agent who didn't keep his weapon unsafe and accidentally shot someone?
Well, yeah, let's finish with that. That was, there's a video or GIF online of him, doing, a handstand in the middle of a dance floor.
No, that was a backflip. I gotta say, it was kind of impressive.
Yeah, yeah. But then a pistol falls out?
Mm-hmm. Like a pistol falls out of his waist, and then it discharges as he picked it up, which means it wasn't on safe.
Oof. In his pants before that, too, by the way.
Yeah, right? That's either the weapon malfunctioned or that was terrible gun discipline. Either way, that weapon probably shouldn't have been in his pants. Like, as if it was broken, like, I assume a fall to the ground wouldn't cause a pistol's safety to, you know, malfunction like that. Assumedly.
Yeah, you'd think not. Did he get charged with anything?
Not that I'm aware of yet. I mean, I suspect that he's not going to be charged. At most, he's probably going to have to issue an apology. He's probably going to get sued by the person who got shot, though, if I had to bet.
I'm sure that person has some lawyers talking to them already. Yeah, wild, though. So where was... This was at in Colorado?
In Denver, yeah.
Yeah. It says here the agent might face criminal charges. But,
I mean, he could. He did accidentally or unlawfully discharge his weapon in a public place, resulting in injury. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. All right. Well, that's enough for weak thoughts for now. And we'll be back with the talk with Scott Gordon. I ended with the Scordon? Gordon?
Gordon? That's the question. That's the reason we're going to go with.
Is he going to be there? That's my that's my amateur radio skills right there. All right.
In like the third or fourth paragraph.
Oh, I see.
So this one is about the foreign minister or whatever from North Korea, and like they don't name him until like the third or fourth paragraph, and they just call him Kim's right-hand man for three paragraphs.
It's like, is he military? Which side of... Yeah, which right-hand man? That's a long table.
Anyway, well, yeah, again, thanks for coming on. So let's start with first introducing you, Scott. You are an associate editor with WisContext, and correct?
That's correct.
And WisContext, how would you describe WisContext?
So WisContext is a web project launched out of Wisconsin Public Television and Radio and UW Cooperative Extension a few years ago. That's been gradually getting up running, and it's a freestanding website in addition to being part of those organizations. We're at wiscontext.org. And the idea of the project is to basically complement the news coverage that our partner organizations do by publishing deeper dives, explanatory pieces, pieces about history, really things that aren't breaking news coverage, but give people a little more background to sort of understand what they're reading about in the news.
Yeah, I've noticed a fair amount of the articles I see from them often, it'll be about something that is kind of a breaking news thing, like news story of the day or the week, but it kind of focuses on another part of it. And I guess that's the context part of the name.
Yeah, exactly. And often, we'll sort of pick certain subject areas and expound on them and kind of keep exploring them here and there over the course of a long time.
Sure. And how do you guys kind of, how do you choose where to focus? Like, what is the important context?
So when the site was first kind of planned and conceived, there were a lot of discussions, I guess, about what we cover and what we don't. And we decided to kind of focus in on a few subject areas that they're each broad in their own way, but they kind of help give us a focus. Certainly, science and the environment and agriculture and health are big parts of that. Also some stuff about money, especially we've had like some things about personal finance and credit and things like that. And, because we're not really equipped to cover breaking news in the first place, and we already work with an organization that already does breaking news coverage, that sort of freed us up to do other things. And we obviously have coverage on our site that deals with state politics, but it's not necessarily horse race political coverage. Yeah. And, the vast majority of what we do isn't driven by, things that elected officials are saying on any given day.
Yeah, I love that, actually. I mean, I think that's an invaluable service. You're also an editor with Tone?
Yeah, ToneMadison.com is a website that a few of us in Madison started a few years ago, and this is totally separate from my job at WisContext. So it's an independent outlet that covers arts and culture in Madison, basically.
Awesome. So let's find out who Scott Gordon is. Like, where are you from? You're from Wisconsin?
I originally grew up in Florida. I've lived in Madison since 2006, minus about a year and a half that I spent kind of wandering away. I mostly grew up in Florida. I went to high school in kind of the Orlando suburbs, basically.
Okay. What brought you to Wisconsin?
My first job out of college was working up here in Madison. At the time, The Onion had a bunch of kind of local offices around the country, including in Madison where Onion started. But by that point, Madison wasn't like the headquarters of the company. But in these local editions they would publish, they had, concert calendars and arts coverage and things. And so I was hired up here to work on that for a while. So that's what first got me up here and first got me sort of interested in the in the music community here, yeah, and in covering arts and culture. Not that I hadn't thought about covering that stuff before, but that was the first time I'd really worked on arts and culture coverage in a super intensive way.
Was that the office on Main Street?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. Good memory.
Yeah, we lived around the corner from there.
Yeah. We lived right down the block from there.
Oh, I see.
Probably about that time. Probably 2006, yeah, actually.
Yeah. Right near where the Echo Tap is, yep, and all that stuff.
Yep. Oh, that's cool. And so then you've been doing journalism pretty much out of school then?
I mean, that's what I went to school for, and that's what I kind of decided early on I wanted to pursue. And, you know, there's been changes and odd jobs and whatnot throughout that time, but that's basically been what I've been up to.
So why journalism? I mean, you're obviously a good writer, and fiction is way easier. Why try to find facts and get people to care about them?
I'm not sure that fiction is easier, because the few times I've tried to write it, I found it like really, really hard, and it made me really respect what goes into that. I'm not really sure. I mean, probably the biggest thing is that in high school, I worked on my high school newspaper, and the teacher who advised the high school newspaper was this English teacher who was just you know, really inspiring and just really you know, really her kind of mentorship and her whole attitude towards the world, you know, kind of really changed my life and really I guess kind of planted that enthusiasm in me.
Awesome.
Interesting. I had somebody do that, something similar for me, but it was for languages. My German teacher kind of set me on my path for my later career.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's, I mean, it's something that you hear about every so often, about, you know, teachers playing these foundational roles in people's lives. And it's really, really is true. Mm-hmm.
I had a teacher who told me her favorite word is assassinate because it had two asses in it. That was inspiring to me.
That's beyond that's that, pretty good.
I wish I had a better story about teachers. Nothing against them, of course, though. So what is an associate editor? Like, I want to get a little bit into like the meat of journalism, because I mean, you know, blah blah blah, national context, fake news, all of that, you know, like what.
So let's open up the hood and see how the sausage is made, so to speak.
So I mean, yeah, what is an associate editor? What does that mean?
I mean, it's that's the job title, but I think what I would just describe what I do for WisContext mostly as reporting. I mean, I do some editing, and because we're such a small staff, mm-hmm, everyone involved in it kind of has this role in kind of steering the site as a whole in some way or another.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, mostly I focus on reporting and writing. You know, I help out with data visualizations and graphics a little bit. I guess associate editor, it's just
a name.
More a product of HR than a description of my, sure, role. If you wanted to get down to like what I'm actually doing from day to day.
Okay.
From my understanding, it's kind of like a almost egalitarian workplace. Has that been different from your other journalism jobs? For instance, The Onion?
Just in terms of how decisions are made and sort of the chain of command and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think in most contexts there's an editor who has kind of some amount of kind of final say over what happens, but there's also somewhat of a, just by nature of how this all works, there's somewhat of a collaborative decision-making process that goes into everything. And, you know, and everyone just works through a process of compromise, basically. And sometimes your editor puts their foot down about something, or so I guess in that sense it's not super different. I mean, the main difference, I guess, is that we're this really new project with a small staff, and you know, that I mean, that certainly kind of shapes how we work.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been some pretty illustrious coverage so far. I mean, you've got the Supreme Court decision should be coming out soon, right? About the redistricting?
Oh, in Whitford?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is expected to come down at some point this summer. I believe sometime in June, people, you know, that's
However long it takes the clerks to write it, but can you give us like a little bit of insight into that, how that happened?
The Wisconsin redistricting case?
Yeah, were you approached with the data, or did you go out and look for it?
Well, I haven't really done a whole lot of really like deep digging kind of data reporting on that in particular. I've written a little bit about it, I wrote a story a while back about how a lot of academics in sort of the mathematics and computing field have gotten really interested in redistricting and have sort of started a whole series of conferences and things to sort of basically find solutions to this whole problem of political gerrymandering. And one of the conferences was at DW-Madison campus, and a mathematics professor at UW, Jordan Ellenberg, has been really active in that discussion. You know, he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about redistricting a while back. So mainly what I've done in what little I've written about that is kind of just look at the conversations people are having and the ideas that people are bringing from mathematics and computing to this whole process. You know, one of the reasons that this most recent round of redistricting in the states was so aggressive was because the mapping software used to draw new legislative maps has become so powerful. It existed before in the previous round of this, obviously, but you know, over 10 years, it developed quite a bit. And so people are also asking, you know, now people have used, now this tool has been used to do these really aggressive, sophisticated, very obviously, partisan gerrymanders. Can technology be used to create maps that are, somehow more fair and representative? And how do you combine the obviously vastly complex computing and mathematics questions with the need for this to be a legislative process that it takes into account human factors?
Mm-hmm. So you said you haven't done a ton of reporting on this, but you have done a lot of reporting on environmental issues, and you said that was a focus of WisContext. I heard you on the radio the other day talking about ticks. Do you have a sign? So we've talked about on the podcast before about the idea of specialization in journalism. Should schools provide minors almost, going into science journalism, so you have science classes? Did you have any sort of education in environmental science or biology or anything like that? I would assume not, but
no, I didn't. I really didn't. And I do think that's a really interesting question about specialization. And, you know, I went to journalism school, and I have kind of often questioned the value of having journalism school as, you know, as a thing. And it's, maybe it's a specialty that shouldn't be quite so divorced up on its own, but, yeah, I mean, over time, I've definitely had to learn a lot about science and really, I mean, when you're writing about science or any complex subject, I think just the most important thing is just being a a good listener and being really patient and not being afraid to, you know, take a bit of someone's, a bit more of someone's time to make sure that you, you know, really understand what they're saying.
Particularly and, like professors or someone that you're quoting in these articles.
Is that right. What you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, it's complex stuff, and people, someone talking to a reporter about, you know, research they've done that's really complicated and really esoteric, they, you know, obviously want to feel that they're listened to and that someone's taking care to not oversimplify or misrepresent what they're putting forth.
Because I'll be honest, the reason that I started reading WisContext and I guess your work in particular is it has had a lot of scientific and environmental articles, and I was a biology major. Like, I've always had an interest in science, though never worked in it. And I love the fleshed out feel of those articles. And I guess, do you think your journalistic background and skills kind of can be applied to anything then? I mean, you write on multiple subjects. I mean, do you think you could approach almost anything? If you got a job tomorrow, a new job that they wanted you to write about, I don't know, cooking or something. How long would it take to get up to speed?
I really don't know. I mean, it's a matter of like spending enough time with the subject matter and talking to enough people and really taking care to understand it, I guess. You know, obviously I think you can cover something, a subject area, without being a specialist or, you know, professionally trained in that field. There's always, you know, the danger of jumping into something that you don't know anything about and getting it wrong.
Yeah.
Not to mention unintentional political or unintentional bias that creeps in occasionally.
That's another thing is, you really have to kind of learn your way around something before you can write about it comfortably with authority and without, you know, accidentally kind of stepping in something. You know, I guess that's always kind of part of your job as a reporter, is to kind of make sure that you understand the, you know, those broader things surrounding the subject.
Mm-hmm. Even if it's not in the text of what you're reporting. I mean,
it's got to influence the text.
Hmm.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's always things that you have to kind of think about and be sensitive about, even if they're not like the focus of a given story.
Sure. Well, I guess we could get into the meat of the issue and get into the onion that is Foxconn. You've done some pretty extensive reporting on that, right?
Yeah, especially looking at the, you know, environmental implications of, you know, having a massive electronics fabrication operation in Wisconsin, and especially the issues of water access and, you know, the plan to draw water from Lake Michigan to serve this factory complex.
Right. And well, we had Fabio Maldonado on a couple weeks ago, and he was describing it was basically a prairie in the area where they're building it. Have you been?
Yeah. I mean, I have, and this was back when it was for a Wisconsin Public Television report that I helped with. And it was back when people were still kind of speculating about where exactly it was going to be, and people in this area were getting, you know, these offers on their property, and so that fueled a lot of speculation, and that's where it ended up being. And so it's Yeah, I mean, it's a fairly rural area, I guess, where, you know, yeah, like you said, like prairie and some farmland and stuff like that.
I don't think most of it's going to be, like, untouched prairie, though. I'm from Racine. I'm from Mount Pleasant. So it's pretty much, yeah, it's mostly farmland, I think, out there.
Yeah, and there's, if I recall, like, a couple other big, like, I think it's a distribution center or something right out there. So there's other, like, industrial developments in the area.
Sure. Can you talk about the kind of broader environment or specific, I guess, environmental impacts from the facility?
Yeah, so one thing throughout this whole process is that there haven't been a lot of specifics about, like, what exactly will be involved here as far as contaminants that people can expect and so forth. And we know that if they're going to be not just assembling LCD screens, but actually fabricating the components on site, for one thing, that's extraordinarily resource intensive, especially water intensive, which is why they're asking for, you know, all this water from Lake Michigan. You know, we know there's various, you know, heavy metals and other chemicals involved in the electronics manufacturing process, and that, you know, if they're going to comply with environmental regulations, they'll have to have a lot of processes in place to treat those. I mean, I guess the thing that interested me the most about it was that, you know, okay, in Wisconsin, obviously we regulate a variety of different contaminants from farms and from industry and so forth, but will this kind of be a kind of a new mix of things for the state to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, we've got Cray supercomputers, but I guess we've never really produced computers on this scale, or even their components.
Right. I mean, I know there's some electronics manufacturing in southeastern Wisconsin, but nothing, you know, nothing quite as large as what they're proposing here.
Their water ask is, what, 9 million gallons?
So the diversion from Lake Michigan was applied for was 7 million gallons per day. And most of that would be going to the Foxconn facility itself, and the rest would be going to some adjacent, you know, industrial and commercial operations. And this is specifically the water that the Racine Water Utility asked to send outside of the Great Lakes Basin for, you know, the use of this facility.
For the Great Lakes Compact.
Yes.
You said earlier that we don't really know the, like, what contaminants may or may not be, released. Or,
present.
Do we not know all that information because of the DNR approval process that went into this? Like, would we normally know that?
Well, as part of the incentive bill for the Foxconn factory that the legislature passed, you know, they did get a pass on some environmental permitting requirements up front, including, you know, submitting an environmental impact statement, which might have been helpful in disclosing some of that stuff. But, you know, I'm not entirely sure. And to be quite honest, like, the last few weeks I've been concentrating a lot on other stories and haven't caught up on a ton of Foxconn stuff. But, you know, we do know that there's a lot of stuff that they'll have to deal with that. And you know, and things that have been problems at other facilities they've run around the world.
You've reported on Water Policy Beyond Foxconn, right?
Largely looking at drinking water and you know, how different places treat it, and you know, issues with lead in drinking water.
Have you found public officials to be care? I don't have a better
responsive to citizens' concerns.
That's a really good question. It's, I mean, the caveat I would give is that, again, like I mentioned earlier, I don't spend a whole lot of time talking to elected officials. Sure. You know, I spend a lot of time talking to scientific researchers, and, you know, when I'm doing drinking water stories, I'll end up talking with people at, you know, city water utilities around the state. And, yeah, I mean, I think, I guess it's kind of hard for me to answer that question. It's also kind of hard to know like what the, what kind of response some of the stories we publish are getting, if only because we're a newer enterprise and still really working to reach people. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to gauge. I mean, obviously, you do talk to a lot of people who are, you know, concerned with people's safety and mm-hmm. passionate about protecting the public. It's hard to make like a generalized statement about public officials.
Do the
overall
are the experts you're talking to, do they seem extra worried? Like, do you get a feel from them that they're like, you know, like screaming from the rooftops?
Well, it depends on and who it is and what the issue is, I guess. Even when someone is working on an issue that they find really urgent, if they're a scientist, they're always trying to make sure to do justice to the urgency of it, but also mm-hmm. do justice to the science of it and not overstate it. I think by and large, like the vast majority of scientists that I talk to who are working on sensitive environmental issues are, really careful to kind of keep the nuance in what they're saying, even when it's, a hot button issue, or even when they're clearly dealing with something that's, a threat to public safety, because that's their job, is to kind of get to, is to kind of get to the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. Sorry, does that answer the question?
It's a good response. I saw your recent data visualization about lead service lines, and have you looked at the problems in water beyond lead? For instance, I know in Beloit here, in the last data that I could find from 2015 indicated like above threshold levels of chromium in our water here.
Chromium I haven't specifically reported on, but I've definitely spent some time on bacterial contaminants, phosphorus, nitrates.
Oh, so agricultural pollutants.
Yeah. In a few areas around the state, including kind of northeastern Wisconsin, like Kewaunee County, there's been widespread problems with private drinking water wells getting contaminated from manure and all the, pathogens that come along with that.
Because the prevalence of industrial agriculture in that area, correct?
Yeah. Industrial agriculture kind of combined with this geology that makes it really easy for things to get from the surface into the groundwater. It's a really obviously really dangerous combination. That's been a big one. I think lead's the one that I've probably spent the most time reporting on. Mm-hmm. One thing that I did a few stories on was a federally funded program that the state DNR had, where they were giving out loans to cities around the state to, help dig up and replace their lead service lines. And we sort of looked at the amount of money that was involved in that program and how they were distributing it and how it compared to the actual need out there. And what we found is, you know, there was clearly enough money that was going to make a difference, but, you know, not nearly enough to address all the lead water pipes that are still known to be out there. And it kind of structurally disadvantaged Milwaukee, especially because Milwaukee has the most lead service lines of anywhere in the state, you know, not surprisingly, being the largest city. And it's the amount of money that it was able to get through that program wasn't necessarily kind of commensurate to how many lead service lines they have.
They put a cap on the population, right? Isn't that, I believe I read your reporting.
There were three different population tiers that each determine how much money a city was eligible to get. And it's just, it's one of those things where it was certainly, you know, a step, but, you know, it was, I think something like $16 to $20 million for, you know, a billion-dollar problem.
Yeah. Oof.
Yeah, it's that amount amounts to like a drop in the bucket compared to how much Milwaukee's going to need. I saw your reporting, Scott, but one question that I had is this program seems to put a lot of the onus on the property owners to come up with the money to fix these lead lines. Do you have any idea of the distribution of these lead service lines between like owner-occupied and rental properties?
That is a really good question, and I actually really don't know how it divides up between rental properties and owner-occupied properties. Maybe that's something I should try to do some reporting on at some point. But yeah, I mean, the issue there is that so you have your city water main that serves your neighborhood or street, and then you have your service line that's coming off of that to your house or building, and that pipe is partially the water utility's property and partially private property. And so that creates some hairy issues with funding the work to get it out. For example, until recently, it's just, I believe this has changed with a recent bill, but I'm not 100% sure if it's been signed. I think it has. You'll have to forgive me. I've been, again, like not on, like on this beat for a few weeks. But so there's this issue with how you can fund the private half versus the public half. And, you know, previously a water utility couldn't use money from its ratepayers to do service line replacement on private property. The problem with that is that if you just replace one half of the lead service line, you know, A, there's still lead there, and B, that can actually make things worse. It can disrupt lead rust that's formed on the pipes and things like that. And there are other theories about ways that can actually aggravate lead contamination. Madison, for example, kind of somewhat famously tried to replace, you know, all of its lead service lines over the course of several years, and it had to get kind of creative with the funding for that. And if I recall correctly, one of the ways the city of Madison funded that, you know, to help out private property owners was to take some money that the city was making from leases on cell phone towers. In Green Bay, I believe the city is using some of the money from the Lambeau Fields, this Lambeau Field sales tax program, and so forth. Yeah, Green Bay had some money that came from from that to help kind of fund lead pipes, lead pipe replacement. And so, yeah, I mean, it is a complex, problem, and, you know, it just, if the state or cities want to actually get rid of all of it, it's going to cost an incredible amount of money. And it's just like with any other infrastructure related problem, be it roads or what have you, is that it's really hard to get people to commit, you know, vast amounts of public funding, for it, because it's not, you know, it's not a politically sexy issue, and it's, you know, it's incredibly expensive. Like I said, you know, it's really a problem on the scale of billions of dollars rather than a few million here and there.
Right. And that's just Wisconsin. This is happening across basically every state.
Yeah. I mean, it is a widespread issue. You know, it was very common to have lead water pipes and lead, fixtures in homes for many years. So, you know, and of course water isn't the only source of lead poisoning. Lead paint is still a major source of lead poisoning.
Sure.
And again, Milwaukee has had some, extensive problems with that.
And they say they've been grappling with that for decades, but hopefully they're making headway.
Yeah. I'm sure you remember there was kind of a scandal with the Milwaukee Health Department not that long ago about, watching some stuff on their lead poisoning response.
It's a thorny problem to solve, but ideally it should be everyone's first priority considering how important drinking water is.
Yeah. And I mean, when you think about the lead thing, you know, for even a few minutes, it's really hard to not take it seriously and really think of it as a really urgent problem, because, you know, this is something that is not supposed to be in your body, at all. And, you know, it's not like certain other metals like copper where your body actually has a use for some amounts of it, but, and the damage it can do to someone over time, particularly a child, absorbing it in small amounts is devastating, and it's cumulative, and it adds up in your system over time. And so it just really makes you think about the fact that, that there's a huge vulnerable population out there that really has already suffered a great deal because of this issue. And, it's pretty incredible to think about the extent of the problem that remains and how, pardon me, and kind of how, stop start the efforts to deal with it really are.
Yeah, it's an overwhelming problem with kind of limited attention and focus.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the, you know, water crisis in Flint, Michigan drew a lot more attention to it, which is both like just unspeakably tragic but at least it's good that it's gotten people to talk about it and think about this a little bit more. But yeah, it is really overwhelming to think about, where it's just, it's something that's so plainly out there. And, you know, the more negligent society is about it, the more we'll just be, poisoning kids and in a lot of cases, disrupting their development for life.
You know, and it encourages bottled water usage so much, which is, then just fueling a problem for future generations.
Yeah, I mean, there's this interesting debate going on about, and this is true in Flint too, about how, about drinking water becoming this increasingly privatized commodity. You know, and of course, Michigan is one interesting illustration of that, because you have Flint still not having a reliable, clean public water supply, but in the same state, you know, Nestle is pumping water to make bottled water, and then people are shipping bottled water to Flint as kind of this charitable gesture. I mean, it's interesting, and it's especially interesting in a state like Wisconsin that has so many small communities with private water utilities, and what the water utility in Madison or Milwaukee is able to do in terms of the staff it has and the, you know, all the treatment processes is able to do and so forth. You know, that's really not the case in communities around the state where.
Yeah. Beloit, there's just Eau Claire, Superior, smaller cities.
Well, I mean, you know, even way, way smaller than that. I mean, you know, places where, you know, there might not even be like a full-time water utility director or what have you. You know, it's not, understandably not an easy problem for these communities to solve, because there just isn't a huge amount of money for them to invest in their water system.
You said you've been working on other things the past couple weeks. We probably have to wrap up soon here, but you want to tell us about anything noteworthy there?
Yeah. So, as we did around this time of year last year, we've been doing a bit more reporting on ticks and Lyme disease. You know, in the upper Midwest, that's obviously a really big public health concern during the summer. The northeastern part of the United States sees the worst of it, but the upper Midwest kind of comes in second as far as the amount of Lyme disease we generally see, you know, and the amount of black-legged tick activity. And so I've been kind of looking into, you know, all the different factors that influence how much risk there is for Lyme disease and how many people end up getting infected. And I'm working on a story about sort of the regional differences in Lyme disease prevalence, because the southern U.S. does not get hit anywhere near as hard as the northeastern U.S. or the Midwest, upper Midwest, I should say. And there's a lot of interesting research out there about just, you know, why that is, and you know, and kind of how ticks in different regions actually might be behaving differently and feeding on different kinds of animals, and how this might influence those differences. So that's cool. That's something I've got in progress right now, and I'm enjoying kind of trying to wrap my head around it. Yeah. A few other things on my plate, as you can probably guess, I kind of pivot a lot from one subject to another. But hopefully we'll be able to keep kind of plugging away on more of this kind of journalism especially in the realms of science and the environment and health.
Yeah, I mean, the tick story you're talking about is, I think, a great example of what we talked about at the beginning, what WisContext does, because it's kind of like a very normal sort of TV news little report on, like, make sure you wear pants when you go out into the woods in June. And, like, that's the story. And they do it every year. But taking that kind of, like, lead, but then going into more scientific, more background, more, you know, whatever, just deeper, is great. Like, that's stuff, you know, I would not know otherwise.
Yeah, and I mean, that really basic, like, public health messaging has a lot of value, too. And, I mean, even people who study, you know, diseases on a really deep scientific level will kind of hammer on that stuff, because, you know, it's important, and getting it through people year after year is a big job. With Lyme disease, there was a really funny incident recently where the Centers for Disease Control tweeted this photo of a poppy seed muffin, and said, can you spot the ticks on this muffin? You know, and the idea was to demonstrate, okay, ticks are really small. They're really easy to overlook, you know, and then there was this close up where some of the spots on the muffin were actually poppy seeds and some of them were ticks. And, it was repulsive and people got mad about it. And I think the CDC actually apologized for it, but it was funny to watch because it actually really got through to people in maybe in a way that maybe, you know, just giving people those kind of pat seasonal reminders maybe doesn't. So
yeah, yeah, in a novel way.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not sure where I was going with that, but
it's a great image to leave us with, Scott.
Yeah.
Well, I think time's about up. Really appreciate you coming on. You do.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, for sure.
I appreciate that.
For sure. Thanks again. And that's Scott Gordon writing with WisContext and Tone Madison, if you're into the music, which we didn't get to. I intended to. But
I feel like we should have you on again to just talk about music for an hour.
Yeah, like where should a 35-year-old go to see music? That'll be the topic.
And what's up with hip-hop in Madison?
Plenty of places. I'm 33, so there's there's lots of places that the olds are allowed. So yeah,
because you know, when I was young, I'd just wander into any place I heard like a drum coming out of, just often people's basements and shit.
Well, you should still do that.
Yeah, I suppose. Just bring the kids.
Not trespassing or whatever, but you know.
Yeah.
Let's break some comfort zones.
Sure. Well, thank you both again. I appreciate this.
Thank you. Thank you again.
All right. Thanks again.
Got some closing thoughts, I am sure. We always have thoughts to close. Or closings to think. There was actually... I don't think we talked about it with him, but... Our guest in the last segment, Scott Gordon, wrote an article about Epic.
Oh, right. I should have been.
Yeah, we just kind of lost track. I think I had it written down as something to ask him about, but I don't know. The headline is Epic Systems lawsuit ruling has wide-reaching impact on employee. That doesn't seem like a good headline to me. Employee rights. Sorry, it didn't fit in the whole Twitter thing there. Has wide-reaching impact on employee rights.
Like singular employee? Like they found one guy?
Well, I guess the actual ruling was one guy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think it was just one person who challenged Epic. anyway, it's. I think it brings up some interesting... I mean, there seems to be a growing concern in this country, and rightfully so, I think, about the tech giants. It's reminiscent of 19th century, you know, going into the 20th century, monopolies and worker rights, and you know, yeah, we're not having kids with arms cut off at Google, but
hey, progress.
Yes. But they seem to be, I don't know, how would you put it, powerful to an extent that is unwieldy. I mean, and shit, even with, like, the news and the congressional hearings and the Facebook and, I mean, it's maybe getting out of hand, gotten out of hand.
Long been out of hand.
Yeah.
I mean, how is the government that is pointedly trying to take its hands off of industry going to control the excesses of the people who, well, as I said, they're trying not to control. And not to mention these companies have like billions of dollars that they can spend on lawyers to bury people in paper. Keep anything from happening.
Which you saw with
Epic.
Yeah. And I'm sure you will see with...
Hopefully Facebook.
I mean, I haven't looked into it, but I would not be surprised if the tech companies have massive lobbying efforts.
Mm-hmm. I know Google spends hundreds of thousands of dollars on it. They were like, what, the second or third largest lobbying group in Washington last year?
Well, and the...
the problem for you know, anyone who might want to start the process of the government wrangling them in is they have focused a lot of their lobbying, I believe, on the Democratic Party, and you're unlikely to have the Republican Party, though, come up with these liberal anti-business laws against them. And, you know, like, they don't need to necessarily lobby the Republicans as much. And so they've really played both sides.
Yeah, you can see that in the Zuckerberg hearings. Like, nobody was really grilling him hard.
Yeah, there's no regulation anytime soon. And then, you know, then we're seeing with Epic, you know, anti-labor practices and court rulings and, you know, it's just disappointing. I mean, not that this was like a Wisconsin state Supreme Court ruling here or anything, but it's disappointing that this has a Wisconsin tie-in to it.
Mm. Well, we're like a microcosm for the country.
Well, and, you know, interestingly enough, yeah, I mean, you know, Google, and you know, you have Silicon Valley in California and Seattle, you know, Washington State with, what, Amazon and Microsoft. I mean, these tech companies are in more democratic of strongholds.
And they're in Madison. I mean, I don't, mm-hmm. Microsoft and Google both have laboratories in Madison.
Mm-hmm. And it's putting probably politicians and activists and people in positions where they feel conflicted, because, you know, we're all fine regulating an industry, but ooh, I don't know, this one gives us jobs, you know.
Yeah, it's because, you know, they're willing to overlook what Epic is doing because look what they've done to Verona.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a lovely little town. It's got some nice restaurants. And
yeah, it was not so vibrant a decade ago.
No, and, you know, the people there don't want to, you know, what, bite the hand that feeds them kind of thing.
All right.
Even if it's not...
keep the medical data flowing.
Okay. More news came out about... Bucksguard, what's his name? Shannon
Sterling Brown.
Sterling Brown. That's weird. I said Shannon because old Packer Sterling Sharp's brother was Shannon Sharp.
Mm-hmm. He's our tight end, wasn't he?
No, he didn't play with the Packers. Sterling Sharp did though. Yeah, somewhere in the back of my head, Sterling and Shannon are intermixed. Anyway, so yeah, I think more video came out. I believe it was acquired by Channel 12 in Milwaukee.
It was just another body cam, right?
Yeah, but it had like extra...
It had more footage after the initial footage cut out. Like the one cop was standing on his ankle.
Yeah, there's a picture of it right here on the WISN 12 News Twitter feed. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, incredibly bad, but just so embarrassing. Like they joke about their overtime pay. They knew exactly what they were doing and who they were doing it to. I can't imagine why they thought there wouldn't be consequences for it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how often do they do that they're so comfortable with that behavior that the notion of accountability is just the furthest thing from their mind?
Mm-hmm. If they don't... Are they even... Yeah... It's not even considered. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not a worry. Like, who's at a job and not worried about beating someone else up at their job?
Yeah, like it's, if a negative, like people can get fired for like just one negative customer interaction.
That's how this should be viewed. People are customers.
Mm-hmm.
Even it's someone that you might suspect.
I mean, policing, like a lot of public services, should be, and it, well, is, and should be viewed as, like, client services.
Yeah.
And they're not. they regard themselves, and more, especially since 9/11, as some kind of military or paramilitary force, and it's they're fighting a war against themselves. Because, you know, it's these cops are from these... I mean, Milwaukee only recently got rid of their residency rule, right? Like, the police were in Milwaukee, were required to live in Milwaukee, so they were part of that community, and so they should not... I don't understand how they could think they're at war with, as I said, their own community.
Yeah, yeah.
There's, like, just some insanity about it.
Was Sterling Brown charged with anything?
I don't think so. That's my knowledge.
It's just wild.
It's just wild. Let me double check that. I don't want to speak out of turn. Brown wasn't charged with anything, and three officers involved in the arrest were disciplined with suspensions ranging from 2 to 15 days. Eight others will undergo remedial training in professional communications. Well, I can give that class. It'll just be like 1 hour of, hey, don't stand on the guy's foot. Like, hey, respect everyone as you would want to be respected.
Professional communications. When you're going to beat someone up, turn off your body camera.
Excuse me.
yeah, it's a shame.
I mean, sure, the guy was illegally parked, but then you proceeded to, like, interdict him like he was some kind of major criminal?
Yeah.
A basketball player.
But just the fucking fact that there's a police officer going to a Walgreens, like, looking for that. Like, what? Since when do cops give a shit about parking over a line or something?
Well, from my understanding, he, like, parked across, like, two handicapped spots in, like, an otherwise empty Walgreens parking lot in his, you know, his probably fancy car. I mean, I kind of understand why someone might be in, like, a police officer might be involved. Like, excuse me, sir, are you aware you're parking illegally? Here's a ticket. Please don't do that again.
Yeah, that's the most, though.
Yeah, I don't see why it needed to escalate into, like, there were at least 11 officers involved over a parking citation.
Yeah.
I think you guys could find a better use of your time. I'm pretty sure there were actual crimes being committed in Milwaukee at that time that you were choosing to ignore, I guess, because of this. I mean, he wasn't hostile, so why even touch him? Oh, he was... In response, the officer... come on, man, you're stepping on my ankle for what, Brown says. In response, the officer said he was trying to prevent Brown from kicking anyone when he wasn't even violently resisting. It was just...
Yeah.
It's like, no, you didn't fear for your own safety. This was punitive.
It's sadistic.
It's sadistic, yeah.
And one of these fucking cops is going to... I mean, how many times have we heard about tragic incidents involving cops where they, you know, I don't know, shoot some poor black kid or something?
Like, Dontre Hamilton? He was just sleeping on Red Arrow Park because, you know, he's homeless and has schizophrenia, but one cop entered, like... approaches him and is like, hey man, are you okay? And then 45 minutes later, a different cop tries the same kind of approach and ends up shooting him.
But I'm saying, how many times have these police officers had prior incidents that were, you know, maybe less extreme, but kind of pointed in a direction of something to be worried about, and they were not...
A pattern of behavior, if you will.
Yeah. Like, is it that hard to find more police officers?
Is it that hard to hold them accountable? I don't understand this part. What?
Yeah. This is probably a little bit tied in with their union, I think.
Right, because, you know, how they don't want to necessarily hold themselves accountable. And I mean, I understand the practicality of having some degree of protection by fiat by virtue of the dangerous job that we have them do, but...
Mm-hmm.
they're not in danger, then you have to expect some measure of accountability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you can say that, oh, I was in danger, so I had to shoot that guy. But if you're not in danger and you shoot that person, you need to be held accountable.
Yeah. No, and yeah, so I think that's why the Sterling Brown one is relevant and interesting, because they don't even seem to be trying to make the argument that there was a reason, right?
Yeah, and it's like administrative training. It's like, what? How much training are you going to spend to like change the behavior of someone who's probably been on the force for a while, who is probably set in their ways to some extent?
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to train them not to do that in an hour. I don't believe you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... I'd kind of like to meet that teacher, because that would probably be an incredibly powerful hour. Like, there would be tears and joy and, like, some real introspective reflection that made people realize the error of their ways, but...
Mm-hmm.
As a teacher, I don't think I could do that.
Yeah.
I mean, the trust falls alone will take up at least half an hour.
Okay. When you catch them, don't then throw them to the ground and kick them.
Don't just let them fall on the ground and then jump on them to restrain them.
All right. Got anything more for us?
The election results in California this tonight should be interesting and kind of indicative of where we're, how things are shaping up and ahead of the midterm elections later this fall. Like, it's just a mess in some of those Southern California House districts.
Yeah, so there's a, so the way that they do elections there is they do the top two vote getters regardless of party. And so there could be some that have two Democrats, some that have two Republicans that face off in the general election. I think because most of these, the districts there, of course not all, but a lot of the contentious ones there, I think Hillary did win. And so there's a thought that, you know, theoretically these should all go to Democrats, but...
Mm-hmm.
Given that system, I mean, like, if you have... Because I guess they're having a lot... They're having an issue with a lot of people running on the Democratic side.
Yeah, because, like, one of those districts has, like, what, seven people running for it? And that seems to be the case in a lot of districts across the country. There's so much enthusiasm for elected office that they're getting, like, lots and lots of qualified candidates.
Which...
We're having a tough...
Which, in, like, our primary... You know, where there's a party primary is great.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great problem to have. But when you have an issue, you know, you can split the vote is the idea. And so you could have, let's say, a district that you expect to get, let's say, 60%, a solid Democratic majority in a general election, but there's only two Republicans running and they each get 20% and the eight Democrats running get, you know, tops 15 or something, then you have two Republicans in the general election. Which is wild.
Really? Yeah.
I mean, it.
We got to go to ranked choice, right? That's the only answer to this.
I totally agree. Totally agree. That would solve, yeah.
Like, 2016 would have been a lot different if I could have been like, okay, there's my number one, and then I guess I'll put her number two.
Yeah, for presidential elections, that would be...
That would really help people vote their conscience and vote practically.
Even in the primaries as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. California, if you don't have it happen where after today's primary elections, there are districts with two Republicans, if that does not happen, and then that will set the groundwork for the blue wave legitimately, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a lot of seats that could be picked up in California. As Democratic as it are, as blue as it already is, there are a number. I mean, it's a huge state. There's a lot of Republicans that do represent districts there, but have been swinging even more blue, and that would be a start to it legitimately happening.
Which, yeah, would be interesting. I love this. I love seeing, you know, I have a soft spot for conservative Never Trumpers. And I like how many of them are like, we need the Democrats to win. It's like, I'm not a Democrat, but please let them win in 2018. Like, we need a powerful opposition reaction.
Right? Just something to, some measure of accountability.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And it, yeah, it's troublesome because, I mean, it's, you don't, you know, it almost becomes like a blind faith the other direction. It's like there are going to be instances where people are voting for Democrats that really aren't worthy. Like, say, like a Joe Manchin. Because you'd rather have Joe Manchin than the Republican, even though
Paula Jean was obviously the stronger candidate.
Oh yeah, but he has that state on lockdown.
I mean, she was a coal miner's daughter. If they had just paid the least amount of attention, if she had gotten any kind of press exposure, it would have been it should have been a layup for her.
I don't know, man. I mean, it actually is an interesting point because. As many people there, like, if you looked at it just from a general election sense, Joe Manchin, I think, is, like, has been leading in every single poll. But when you take out the people who are voting in a Republican primary, who are predominantly conservative, but, and who would vote for Manchin, but they weren't voting in the primary for the Democrat candidate, yeah, it brings up an interesting point that maybe a more progressive person from the left could have challenged him more.
Right. I mean, look what how Cuomo's being challenged by Cynthia Nixon. He's been trying to sprint left.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's getting winded running so hard left.
Oh, God, progressive challenger.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about Nixon a little more in depth some episode. It's an interesting campaign. It's an interesting model of being willing to challenge an incumbent Democrat from the left.
Well, it's just amazing how much demand there obviously is from voters that the person like, obviously she's never been a politician before, but just the fact that she's like, hey, let's have some accountability and push for progressive policies, and just apparently that people in New York are eating it up.
As they should. I mean, that's a... Cuomo in New York is a really good example of a Democrat not being left enough in a state that clearly has, I mean, at least, I don't know the entire breakdown of the state. I know that they, you know, it's kind of like any state with a urban liberal center, you know, their legislature is going to be skewed more right than maybe the whole population. But, like, they... for the last number of how many elections, they vote Democrat. I mean, it's a Democrat stronghold. And the fact that you have some centrist pandering governor there.
Well, and the worst part was is that even, like, their legislature is, like, overwhelmingly Democrat, but there was this group called the IDC, the Independent Democrat Coalition or something of that nature, but it was, like, 8 senators in their state senate who... went with Republicans and basically blowed everything they wanted through, even after, you know, they had been voted as Democrats. I mean, that they kind of reformed that, but Cuomo still went to an IDC fundraiser, so I don't know. It's just that dynastic and fucking insidious insider nature of politics that is turning people off, and hopefully we can move beyond it.
Well, and, you know, historically, New York would be one of the epicenters of political machines.
Yeah, I mean, and corruption.
Yeah, you go read about, like, any period, in, you know, like, Lincoln's time even, you know, the times of the Roosevelts and...
Chester A. Arthur.
Yeah, they're dealing with... The New York political machine is a... I think from both parties...
Right, Tammany Hall. When was that heyday? Yeah, it's both parties.
Yeah, it's long standing.
I mean, it's like these parties have to develop this infrastructure and gather these people, and so it inevitably turns into, like, these institutions that form around dynasties, like the Daily political machine in Chicago, for instance. And so, yeah, these people are working. They have, you know, it's a confluence of incentives that keeps the same people in charge.
Mm-hmm.
So all those people have an in, yeah, never mind, go ahead.
No, it's like The Wire did a great kind of exploration of that in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, we should probably say goodbye. We want to thank again Scott Gordon for coming on the pod. Make sure to check out WisContext. What is there? Is it www.wiscontext.org?
Yep.
Okay, and you can find them on Twitter and all that too. They do great reporting, particularly if you are interested in a little bit more academic of things without getting, like, you know, reading journal papers and stuff. You can find us on numerous podcasting platforms. And you can email us at tmwttpod@gmail.com. If there's anything you ever wanted us to talk about, use the hashtag TMWTT on Twitter or hashtag embarrassingWisconsin. Anything else you want to say?
Have a good week.
Have a great week, I'd say.
Yeah, have a great week.
Have an amazing week, people.
And remember, the midterms are coming.
Midterms are coming. It's like sounds threatening when you put it in the way of like,
well, and it's
Game of Thrones. Yeah. All right. We'll see y'all later.
Days are sunny. Days are rain. Destroy the myth and we'll break our chains. Break your chains!